Well, children are our happiness, you know, our joy. They bring a different perspective to life. If we are all adults, well, where would life be? You know, we'd be much of a doldrum, I say, you know. There'd be no happiness, no joy. You wouldn't hear the screams of children or playing, doing their thing. And I often wish I could still run the same like them, you know, run around like them and skip and all that. So, yeah, oh, dear me, they bring joy. And, you know, it's life to you. It's keeping this strong perspective that you do have life, you know, and they are around you to remind you of the life you were and you are now, you know.
Welcome to Season 3 of Her Story. This season delves into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. I'm Beck Bowman, and I'll be with you each week as we get to know these remarkable women whose lives have had a profound impact on communities throughout this state they choose to call home. Together, we'll meet women who are cultural and environmental custodians, women in STEM and in business, women who care for the health and well-being of those around them, women who are changing the world from right here in WA. In this special musical edition of Her Story, we get to meet Kankawa Nagara. Kankawa is a proud Gunayandi Walmajari Bunuba woman who you may know by the name of Olive Knight. Kankawa is a blues and gospel singer-songwriter who writes in Walmajari, Kimberley Creole, English and other languages of the Fitzroy Crossing area. She brings a message of hope and healing to the First Nations communities in the Kimberley. In this week's episode of Her Story, Kankawa talks about her love of blues and gospel music, the interdependence of music and the alcohol industries, and her hope for future generations of First Nations communities in the Kimberleys. This is Season 3, Episode 12 of Her Story with Kankawa Nagara. Kankawa, thank you so much for joining us on Her Story. You are about to be inducted into the WA Women's Hall of Fame for 2024.
Yeah.
How do you feel about this impending induction?
I do feel quite overwhelmed by it and very excited at the same time, because you sort of float along life and think that, well, look, nothing's going to happen, and so you just do your thing, you know, make the world a happier place or contribute to the world as much as you can. And so if no one recognises you, well, you know, it's all the same. The world will still go on, you know, and you'll be still there looking after it, as it were. It's a concept that you only hear about, that other people are involved in, you know, and doing these sorts of things. But a person who's just ordinarily a world person, you know, living in your life and all that, so you're not, don't expect these things to happen, yeah.
I suppose it is fair to say you're an ordinary person, but you have also done some amazing things. You have helped to create the first Waramajari dictionary.
That's true.
You have toured the world with Hugh Jackman.
Definitely. 5 times, I think. And
you've released 5 albums. These are all the actions of someone who is extraordinary.
Well, that's so nice to know. At least being told by someone else.
When you first started looking at language, because the sense that I get of you is someone who is, music is very important, but also the words, the language that is used, the stories that are used. And when you started with creating this dictionary, did you have already that love of stories and that love of words?
Yes, I am quite well versed in the love of stories and love of words, because I fondly remember my time as a nomad, travelling, directly roaming the land with my clan, and how versed I was with all of the stories that are being told. And I had a unique upbringing also, because within my clan, I was the eldest, child of the group of people, and they actually taught me a lot of things that they would teach boys, men, you know, take them out hunting and all this sort of thing. And so they actually took me as a boy, but I was a girl. Yeah.
Do you know why that happened?
Well, they were all my relatives. Like I was, to some of them, I was like a great relationally, like culturally. And so they respected me, even though I was a child, because when you're considered a great within the culture, then even your elders respect you. And
What does that mean, to be a great?
A great is someone who, like, I'm a great myself. I have greats, you know. I have great-grandchildren, 8 of them. Now, they all, I have to respect them, even they are small, you know. I have to say, look, well, when I go to school and do the work at the school at the moment, you know, I'm involved in the school too with lyrics and other songwriting and language. And the children would run out of their classrooms and call out each time I go out into the classrooms. They'd say, oh, my greats would be there. Oh, our daughter has come. You know, so, and I'd respectfully, you know, just honour these people because they are my my future ancestors. So,
And part of honouring those people is also to advocate for them.
That's right, yes.
You've been really active in advocating for more action to be taken around fetal alcohol syndrome.
That's right.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Now, I was with a group of women who were actually, with a women's group in Fitzroy Crossing, who actually thought the seriousness of this particular condition, because we hadn't heard what it was, you know, until I happened to, well, this was what happened with me. I was out in my own school, and I happened to accidentally hear of a person someone who has come from the United States and was talking about this thing called fetal alcohol syndrome, which they had studied and learnt over there amongst the indigenous people in the USA. But we hadn't heard about it, you know. The schools termed it as ADHD and that sort of thing, you know, didn't really kind of delve into the thought of what was the cause behind it, because there was, you know, it was so prevalent that every child couldn't have just ADHD, you know, been ADHD conditioned, you know, because all of the children, like you get a majority of these children who were, you know, had all these learning difficulties.
Really high ADHD rate.
yes.
Like so high that maybe it's not ADHD.
Yes, that's right. And we finally realised that, oh, look, there's something else now. And then the women's group, who I honour the people who were at the helm of this, who guided us through, the women, and like June Oscar, our leader at the time, and a few other women who did begin to explore and research, and took people on side, you know, doctors and scientists and all those people who started studying and finding the real cause of this so-called ADHD. Which they then we thought realizing it and with the causes of it, and then we said, oh, this is something else, and called it fetal alcohol spectrum disorder.
So tell me, have the rates of fetal alcohol syndrome disorder dropped over the last 30 years?
Yes, I think so. I think so. Because of the awareness of it, you know, we're having to learn where what the causes are now, and that there's a lot more prevention methods, you know, and lots of education going on, you know, with pregnant women and with women who... So there's a lot more care, you know, at least a lot more care and awareness about preventing the condition from happening.
What were some of the earliest actions that you took to start creating this awareness in the community?
Well, a lot of the actions were mainly educational, like there'd be women's meetings, you know, bush meetings and all that sort of thing, and then finally connecting with this particular lady who came over to Queensland, actually, to a festival there, and I heard her over the radio, and which was an accident from accidentally hearing, and then I thought, well, suggest it to the women and bring her over here. Then we can...
There's no such thing as accidents, is there?
No, not at all. No. Yeah, that's what I always... Well, nothing happens in accidents, so no.
Yeah. So you brought her over?
Yeah, we brought her over, and then she spoke about it, what they've done with Indigenous people in the USA and how kind of intense it was, and the studies that was quite, they'd been very involved with it very much so, you know, and having to see a lot of evidences there and what alcohol has caused and all that. And so she was able to share and the methods of preventing it and how to work with the individuals who were kind of affected by it, by alcohol actually. And
that generation, that first generation of children who were diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder are now of an age where they are young adults and they are having their own children.
True.
Are you seeing that there is like an ongoing effect generationally from this?
I don't think so. I don't think so. It's not if that child who has grown up into an adult and has her or his own children, the effect isn't you don't see what the child that was actually affected by their parent, you know, their mother having to drink. But if the mother doesn't drink, you know, if the mother doesn't drink, well, the evidence is better. You don't see a child with the same condition, you know?
And I suppose that child who was diagnosed with FASD is going to have that awareness about alcohol during pregnancy.
That's true.
They're going to have that from a very young age, so they're going to already be very alert to the dangers of
drinking.
Yes,
of course, yeah, they will.
Olive, as someone who works in the music industry, there's such a connection, such a tight relationship between alcohol and the music industry. How do you feel about that relationship when it comes to performing in places where alcohol use is actively encouraged?
Well, look, I have performed in those places, but I see a lot more people there who are not involved more with alcohol. I just talk about one particular performance that I did in Broome, and people were there who weren't interested in the alcohol. They didn't go there for the alcohol. They came there for the music and to hear the story of the music and all that. So they were more kind of tuned to what they came for the music. And I did see, I was so privileged to witness there in front of me, just coming to my concert for the first time, my own son, my eldest son. And the alcohol was flowing freely that night, but he had changed into a different man. I'm so proud to see him go and purchase himself water at the bar rather than beer, you know. And it was such a thrill to me to see my child who was sort of been so low down in the bottom of the rung to come up and just be a different man altogether with all of the drinking that was going on in the venue here.
That's so lovely. I'm so proud of your son.
Thank you.
Because it is hard when everyone else is.
That's
drinking.
Right. It was hard, but he has moved on, you know, and from just leaps and bounds, and he's now a consultant with the Men's Shed, and it's called the Change in Ways, and how he's now working with men who have been involved in domestic violence and all this sort of thing, and he's doing a lot of good work there. So,
do you think
having to live the whole thing himself, you know, it's a lived-in experience and changing other people. Yeah.
Do you think we need to find more venues and more ways of enjoying music that don't necessarily involve being in bars or being in clubs and pubs?
Yes, I think we should. We should, because music is a conveyor of good things, of a good spirit and good you know, understanding of yourself, finding yourself in music and the stories that we tell. Because I don't see myself as a stage person who wants to entertain, you know, people affected by drugs and alcohol. I want to see them listening to me, having a good time, you know, dancing to my music or just listening to my stories. And I want to convey my culture across, you know, with my language and whatever stories I tell within those lyrics. Because I'm a climate change advocate, as well as, you know, I fight for the land and I do all that sort of thing, and for the mental health, those who are affected by mental health and the youth. So I'm out there conveying these stories through my music. But I do not wish to see, you know, people who are affected by alcohol there. I want them to listen to the stories.
And the thing is that music is such a high in itself. It brings that joy, brings that sense of heightened experience.
That's right.
Mm. When was the first time that you really understood the impact of music on you as a person?
Well, the impact that it had on me was times when I've gone through terrible times in my life and rejection and all that sort of thing. So when I heard songs that more or less conveyed rejection and you know, broken hearts and a lot of stories that have not gone good and all that sort of thing, so it brought me to a sense of being where look, I'm going to rise above those things and present something nice, you know, out there to the world, and I'm not going to stay within that enclosure of you know, having to what these people are singing about, you know. And if it's their own selves who want to stay within those heartbreaks and all that, but I want to do a better thing, you know, with my music, so to heal hearts and to be, you know, to tell of good things and so.
You have had some really good things in your life, including your late husband Jim.
Yes.
Who were your role models when it came to you having these loving relationships?
Well, there were lots of role models in my time. So as I speak about my nomadic life, my role models were those men, my greats, you know, my ancestors, and like who treated me like a future ancestor, even though I was just small. And they'd just be so, you know, delicate with me and carried me around and taught me this, taught me that. And I'd spend hours at a time, because traditionally, at night, they'd not go near the women's camp. They'd create a camp for you, like they'd a talking a place, a circle, away from the women's camp, and they'd sit there for hours till almost daybreak, you know, telling stories and all the sort of thing. I'd sneak out from the women's camp and spend time with them and fall asleep on their laps, and oh dear me, it was such an endearing moment, and the moments that I miss, and I feel emotional at times, you know, when I think about those things and haven't been brought up that way. Yeah.
So you had these men in your life who were gentle.
Gentle and caring.
And caring. Mm. And that.
And what the important person was my stepfather, who raised me. Now, traditionally, let me tell you about these stepfathers in those days. My mother was given to this gentleman. He was a strong lawman from the southern desert there in the south of the Kimberley. Now, within the culture, the strong lawmen, the elders, didn't save the child that wasn't theirs. If they took on a woman with a child that she's already had, they destroyed the child. So that was the harshness of it.
They killed the child.
Yeah, they killed the child. But me, this dear father, dad, stepdad, dad, from the desert, took me in and raised me as his own and cared for me. Took me out and taught me a lot of hunting skills and just, so I have strong, dear me, I feel so emotional at the moment, you know, because this gentleman was so wonderful, so caring, heart full of love.
I'm so glad that he was your stepfather, and that I'm so glad that you got to live that life with him.
That's right, yes.
And that you got to live.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as an older woman, you provide care, foster care, for younger people in your community.
That's right, yeah. I raised two boys, two of my sister's men, and one of them has actually passed on, sadly, through suicide. And there's another one who's frequenting the prisons at the moment because of him being a fetal alcohol spectrum, full spectrum of it. And unfortunately, life hasn't really dealt well with him. But he's very much loved by us, you know, by me, and I'm his mum, you know. He always, so nothing has changed there. So I'm older now. I cannot foster any more children, but they are around me all the time. My grapes are around me and my grandchildren are around me.
I see such joy in your face when you talk about your grapes, when you talk about the children that are around you. What do you think it is that children bring to your life and to your community?
Well, children are our happiness, you know, our joy. They bring a different perspective to life. If we are all adults, well, where would life be? You know, we'd be much of a doldrum, I say, you know. There'd be no happiness, no joy. You wouldn't hear the screams of children or playing, you know, out there and doing their thing. And often wish I could still run the same like them, you know, run around like them and skip and all that. So, yeah, oh, dear me, they bring joy. And they, you know, it's life to you. It's keeping this strong perspective that you do have life, you know, and they are around you to remind you of the life you were and you are now, you know, even though you're old.
That's one of the main drivers for your climate activism and for the social activism that you take part in. At the moment, one of the, and you just alluded to it, but one of the things that you're really passionate about is reducing suicide rates in the Kimberley.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What can be done about the high number of young people who are taking their own lives?
Well, look, I don't think anyone has really found the answer to, even though there are talk fests and many, many talk fests, to tell you the truth, of how to attack this issue and how to and find solutions for it. But in the meantime, I'd like to just say something about the project I'm involved in. I've been quite, you know, keen to work with people who have asked questions. Like, I'm working with a couple of people at the moment who are my colleagues, I call them, who have been quite strong in finding out the solutions. Like, what is happening here? I worked with one of the ladies. She's in Melbourne at the moment, a good friend of mine. And we have now formed this thing called the Ears of the Heart. Now, what it is, it's a transformational thinking concept, which we are exploring at the moment, and I've already been involved in two retreats that sort of involves people in listening to nature, listening to themselves, and finding themselves within the listening. And what can they, when they listen, because the indigenous people have two components, the ear up here that listens to the story, and then there's another ear in the stomach, which is called the lian, or the bilir, and that's another ear, which deciphers the story, which dissects the story that you hear from this component up here, and then you begin to, what was the true story I heard? You know, what are they telling me? You know, what is that person telling me? So I have to find out the story down here. So I dissect that, what I've heard, and then form it into a story. So we've exploring this idea, how that because I said straight out to my colleague, look, I don't think these people are listened to. The youth aren't being listened to. They have a story down here that need to be heard. You know, people, of course people know, you know, in these talk fests you'd hear people talk about dysfunction, you know, dysfunction in the family or dysfunction here and there and the rejection and the neglect and all that. But we, coupled with all of those thoughts, you know, the things that are being spoken of widely, you then begin to see, like, explore further. Come, listen to the story. Who is this person? Who is this person? Can I find out who you are, you know? And tell me, please, let me spend time with you, you know? So, because these people need to find themselves, the concept I'm talking about is finding yourself. Who are you? Who are you in here, you know? What have you got? I tell the indigenous people, wherever I am, you have two components. You have an ear up here that listens to stories and all that, but you also have another one. You didn't lose it, regardless of what impacts came to you, whether it was social media or whatever. It didn't change you. You still have two things. You've got the listening and the hearing here.
The Wurundjeri Dictionary.
Yes.
Is the ears in your head.
That's right.
Those were the words that were heard by the ears in your head, but the music was this ears.
That's right, the ears of the heart.
The ears of the heart.
That's right.
Could you play for us one of your songs?
Yes, I'd like to play a very new song for you, but it's in Wurundjeri, my language. So I'll just explain it, what it is all about. The story is all about the disappearance of our elders, the storytellers. People who we needed around, you know, to teach the young people, the children, their culture and keep them stable. So the stability relied on these elders. But a lot of them are going, leaving us, dying. So the question in this song is, where have they gone? The disappearance, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Are the elders still with us?
Well, they... In Fitzroy Crossing, we've lost them. Just about. We've lost them, especially the men.
But spiritually, are they?
Yes, they are there. I think they've been passed on to the people, their relations and all that. And they are still being held by the next generation, you know. And the presence of them, like the physical presence of them, isn't, you know. So this is a question just asking. You know, people, like, where have they gone?
when you think about the future for your people, and when you think about the best possible future, the dream utopian future that you want to bring into being, what would it look like to be a healthy, spiritually nourished community?
Look, I envisaged a very, within the last 3 days and within my project, I envisage a very, very strong community of people who have doubled their strength from what they've learned and from seeing the many setbacks and the many issues and the problems that impacted us, and we were so overwhelmed by it. But then we've risen above it. You know, we've risen and we've travelled on. We've gone stronger. And like, for instance, I was talking to someone about the social media that's impacting on our children right now, which is a cause of badness, of crime in the Kimberley all over. I believe there's social media is causing the crime, because everyone is conversing all over this country. Gangs are conversing through social media. Now, if the social media was changed by us, the indigenous people, and we'd create a much more caring, based on our own culture, we'd be creating something with the help of all technology and people who are expert at it, to create a social media type that actually spoke to each other in wherever we were in this whole of this country, that the young people would ask questions like, now how many help old people have you helped? Because mm-hmm. that was in our culture. We helped our old people. We fed our old people. So how many, when you went hunting, how many animals did you kill to bring to the old people? Or who did you help today? You know, that sort of thing. Because this is what's happening with crime. How many people have you held a knife to, or have you stolen, a car that you stolen? Now, I can outnumber you in the next town, you know, that sort of thing. So why not outnumber or calculate different ways within our own culture? Create a social media that'll assist us to be stronger.
The gamification of kindness.
That's right.
Rather than turning crime into a game, turning violence into a game.
That's right.
That is beautiful. That, I really love that. That's taking something that is the white man's technology.
That's right.
And turning it around and creating something that is uniquely,
so uniquely culturally yours. Based, you know, with the caring and the sharing that we were actually ingrained into us ever since. You know, whenever, you know, like ever since our inception, or whenever that was, you know, it was continuous. That's why my music is a continuous kind of flow with blues, having to choose blues, because it was continuous. The story is continuous. It's repetitive.
That cycle is really important to First Nations cultures, isn't it? That idea that it is never ending.
That's right. Number one, our music, of course, was continuous, because you it was a cycle. You sang the cycle of the story. You didn't kind of divert from it, or if you diverted, there was strong punishment, actually, and that's what it is. And so you continued the story, and all of our learnings. Now, every day, my elders would take me out to the bush. My father, my stepfather would take me and show me the same tracks of a goanna there. Now, this is the way you look at this, track this goanna. If you track it backwards, you will not find it, because you'll run into something else, you know. You'd be forever looking for the goanna, you know. So this is the way. Look for its tracks this way, over and over and over again, till I learned. Now, and also I lived with several clans during my nomadic days, you know. One of the elders there who'd speak the same thing. I called him as a town crier, because every night he'd repeat the story in riddles. It was our means of survival. Now, if I, as a child, didn't listen to those riddles and take the story in through the ears of the heart, there'd be danger. You know, there was danger lurking out there. There were tribes who wanted to come and clean out the other tribe, you know. There was danger out there. So we had to listen, because he had to say it in riddles, and it was repetitive until I got it, you know, as a child. And at night, our parents would tell us, shut up and listen to what this old man is saying.
And that's what you're doing with your music now?
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, Kankara, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with me and with everyone listening today. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I look forward to seeing you in concert soon.
Thank you.
Thanks to Kankawa Nagara and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women and femmes who make Her Story on RTRFM happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Rachel Ang and Madeline Mitchell are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Her Story is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was produced on Wadjuk Noongar Boodja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respects to the Aboriginal elders of the land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au.